This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Yvonne Bailey was just a year old. Dakota Styles was 3. Cherish Periwinkle was 8. They are but 3 of the 20 Florida kids who have died since April of this year. Kids who had some contact with the Florida Department of Children and Families. It's an agency whose mission is, quote, protect the vulnerable, end quote. And it sees itself to be, quote, recognized as a world-class social services system.
Anyone who simplistically tells you the answer is pull more, pull less, you know, and or throw more money at it doesn't understand the complexities of this. It is so complex.
That's Esther Jacobo, interim secretary at the agency, the Department of Children and Families. The agency faced more scrutiny this week from both a panel of child welfare judges in Miami-Dade County, as well as the public at an event in Broward County. To discuss all this on the Florida Roundup on WLRN, Carol Marvin Miller from the Miami Herald, Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald, and Greg Allen from National Public Radio are with us in studio. Carol, you've done an enormous amount of work with child welfare in this agency through the years. What sparked the hearing with all 5 of the child welfare judges in Miami-Dade this week?
I think they've been watching this story unfold over several weeks. And the stories they were reading in the paper were consistent with their own experiences in the courtroom, where they've had tremendous difficulty getting real traction with DCF in their efforts to protect children. The judges are in a pretty unique situation. Ultimately, they have the last authority over kids in their jurisdiction, and if a child meets a terrible outcome, which is a euphemism for if a child dies, that's on them. And one of the judges who sat on that extraordinarily rare en banc panel was Michael Hansman, who had one of these 20 children. A little boy named Jaden Villegas had been removed from his mother and sent to live with his father, who appeared to be what they call a non-offending parent. And what he described, not in these words, but as a kind of drive-by home study, resulted in a recommendation that Jaden go to live with his dad. And within very short order, Jaden was in the hospital and brain dead. They kept him alive for a few days to harvest his organs. And I think that was extremely moving. That was just a terrible, terrible event for this judge. The other judges have experienced similar things. What I hear all the time is that there's nothing they can do to get DCF to act on behalf of some of these kids. They will not remove children unless and until the circumstances become literally life-threatening. And DCF is often disinclined to go to court just to ask the judges to order parents to accept services that they critically need. So I think the judges chose this step, which, again, was just extraordinarily rare. You've never seen an entire division of judges sit en banc on a hearing. They did that, I think, to express to DCF their immense displeasure over how things are turning out now.
The focus of this hearing was one particular tragic case. But what did we learn about the systemic issues that were on display on this hearing in Miami-Dade with all 5 of the child welfare judges?
Well, my analysis of that case was that they were using this one child to pull back the curtain on these systemic issues that they've been experiencing now for really years, quite some time. This was a 1-year-old boy when he first came on DCF's radar. And for reasons of severe domestic violence between his mom and dad, I think that first call to the hotline in 2009 involved an event in which the father broke into the mother's home, locked her in a laundry room, and kidnapped the child. The father was criminally charged for that. And DCF assumed that the child was safe because the father was facing charges, and the mother told them that she had left town, which may or may not have been true. We suspect it probably wasn't. And even if she had left town, they didn't know where the baby was. Mm-hmm. It could well have been with the violent father. So nothing happens. The case comes back in 2010 when the father was knifed by the mother. There was another incident of domestic violence that resulted in a knifing. and the mother got arrested. Both parents have been repeatedly charged for domestic violence offenses. And once again, nothing happens. I think in either 09 or 10, the family was referred to a program in Homestead called Project SOS. They had expressed willingness to access and complete the services, but they never did. And so once again, you kick the can farther down the road.
Yeah.
And then the child ends up on the radar again in 2013. And that's the point at which DCF went to court, and they asked Judge Rosa Figueroa to order the family to accept services. And her answer was, no, I order you to shelter the child because this has been going on long enough, and whatever it is you're doing is not protecting the child.
Let's talk about real quick the role of the judges in this system, because at this hearing, clearly they were focused on one particular case, but we did hear and read about some of the back and forth between DCF and the role of a child welfare judge. So in this particular instance, the judge wanted to take the child out of the situation. Is the judge the ultimate protector here, not the DCFS or the DCF?
Yes and no. The judge did indeed have the authority under statute to order that the child be sheltered. But here's the problem. In the 2009 and the 2010 case, the judges had no real access to this child because DCF wasn't going to court to tell a judge that the child was at risk and to ask a judge to do something, to order services, to shelter the child, whatever. There is clearly a division of labor between the executive and the judicial branches, and you see frustration regularly from the judicial branch because their attitude is, if something goes wrong, other than the investigator or the caseworker, I'm going to be the one who doesn't sleep at night. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Judge Hansman told me he has not slept at night, and he has seen the face of poor Jaden Villegas and every toddler who walks in that courthouse. So they have a clearly well-defined oversight role on behalf of dependent and vulnerable children. But they are dependent upon DCF to provide them with analyses, records, documents, investigations from which they draw conclusions. And it's the old story, garbage in, garbage mm-hmm. out. Judge Hansman, with regard to Jaden Villegas, wrote an order about a week or two after that child died requiring that every time DCF is in his division with a placement or custody decision that they want the judge to ratify, he's going to hold a hearing because, as he said in this strongly worded order, he no longer has faith in the quality of the home studies that were being provided to him. And you hear that quite a bit.
No faith on the judicial part of the judges responsible for child welfare, at least in Dade County. We're talking about the systems with the Department of Children and Families in Florida, clearly under scrutiny this week with a 5-judge panel in Miami-Dade for child welfare, discussing a particular case. Carol Marvin Miller from the Miami Herald with us. This also, of course, became a focus a little bit with the legislative branch of the Florida government. Tuesday night at Broward College's South Campus, a separate hearing about protecting Florida's most vulnerable kids. And more than a dozen local lawmakers sat and listened to people like Pat McCabe, a foster parent.
One reason things aren't changing fast enough is there's no anger. There's no outrage in this room. So I'm here to represent Relia Wilson's ghost and say you guys need to get some anger and outrage in you to change the existing conditions.
Wilson was, of course, the foster child with DCF who disappeared when she was 4 years old in 2000. The agency didn't know about it for more than a year. A report of the case called DCF an agency, quote, engulfed in scandal. Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald, you cover Tallahassee. Is this agency likely to come under legislative scrutiny when lawmakers reconvene?
Well, I have to say that the hearing that occurred this week is really an anomaly. Now, having watched legislators react in the past to things, oftentimes it's because there's a pocketbook issue. We've seen consumer protests related to citizens insurance or relating to something going wrong. But this is not something that is affecting people's pocketbooks. This is outraging people. And the fact that it drew this kind of a crowd, and there was people that stood up and said, we need more outrage, it hits a nerve. Mm-hmm. And because we're entering into an election year, I think that there is the possibility that if legislators don't respond, they will be tarred with some kind of brush that says, look at what you're neglecting. And in an era where campaign money is just flush in Tallahassee, where corporations can control things and get what they want, neglecting this group of people, and children especially, could really, I think, force some action. I'm not predicting it will, though.
But, Carol, we've been here before. The Wilson case in 2002, a review there pointed to higher pay for caseworkers, more review panels, background checks. A 2011 tragedy, of course, led to a number of recommendations, 24 different recommendations. What is the action plan for this agency moving forward?
I think the first thing that they want to do is they have brought in Casey Family Programs to help them review both the individual cases of the children who passed away this year. I think they want Casey Families to look at the so-called transformation, which was the reform effort that former Secretary David Wilkins implemented after Nubia Barahona died in 2011. The problem with the transformation is this: the task force that looked into the circumstances of Nubia Barahona's death essentially was saying, we need more and better investigations, we need higher quality investigations, we need to screen out fewer calls, we need to look more seriously when allegations arrive involving children mm-hmm. either in foster care or who had been adopted. But the transformation that Mr. Wilkins launched is in almost every way inimical to the recommendations of the Barahona panel. What the transformation stands for is screen more calls, do fewer investigations, have less supervisory oversight and third-party or second-party review. And there are advocates all over the state who are saying this is a disaster yep. waiting to happen.
At the time of those 2011 recommendations by then Secretary David Wilkins, he said, quote, I want to make it clear this move will not increase the burden on Florida taxpayers. This department can and will reduce its overall operating budget, but will not do so on the backs of the frontline workers. That was the response of the secretary of those recommendations back then. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, Carol Marvin Miller of the Miami Herald, Marilyn Kloss of the Herald, Greg Allen of National Public Radio along with us, and you are as well. Feel free to join the conversation at 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576, and our online chat at WLRN.org. Jack joins us here on the Florida Roundup from Pompano Beach. Jack, go ahead.
Well, having been involved with the department for many years in an executive position, I can say that there's no instant pudding. First, that Kara Marvin Miller has done an outstanding service to the children with her articles and the way they're written. The problem is that DCF is part of the executive branch of government, headed by the governor. Every time we have a new governor, there's a new philosophy, and it goes from centralizing the services in Tallahassee, where all the major decisions are made there, to decentralization and having the regions or the districts or the counties, whatever it may be, make the decisions there. That's one issue, and so there's no consistency. The major problem, and Carol touched on this, is the quality of the investigations. That's where it starts. First is the phone calls that go to the hotline. The second is when you send an investigator out, what's the quality?
And this was something, Jack, that was pointed out in the 2002 recommendations. This has been something that was pointed out in the 2011 recommendations. So we've known that the quality of the investigations, Carol, is key to the quality of the care that the children ultimately will receive from this agency. So I guess the question that we have to ask ourselves is, you know, 12 years after Wilson, 2 years after more tragic cases, 4 months and 20 children here died, what's changing?
Well, and Jack, stick around. That's Jack Moss, who was the top administrator in Broward County for a long time. And I want to ask Jack a question. What happens with DCF is it's very, very cyclical. And when you have either one hideous child death that leads to a task force, or you have something like this, or that awful October of 97 where 5 or 7 kids died in about a week, then typically lawmakers will jump into action, and you'll see some kind of comprehensive reform launched that typically involves an infusion of new dollars. The new dollars never last because the economy tanks, the politics change, and typically you will see the case worker, the investigator salaries rise and then fall again. The ratio of worker to case will decline and then rise again. And Jack, here's my question for you. Money isn't the answer to everything, of course, but wouldn't it be nice to try it once?
Well, I think that's necessary, but more important than that is the lack of consistency. You need the money in order to retain the consistency, both in terms of the staff, so they stay there, and the day they're hired, they don't take it as a temporary job and looking for something with higher pay, but they take it as a part of a career ladder for them. In the 6 or 7 counties where the sheriffs do the investigations, and I haven't seen any recent numbers, I think you'll find that there are fewer problems with the investigations than in counties where the department does the investigations. The sheriff has the sworn police officers who are generally in a supervisory position. These are folks that have years and years of experience doing investigations. There's a much better, higher quality of review. The sheriffs are constantly complaining there's not enough money to support what they're doing. And I agree with that. And I think that's the first step in improving the system. The second step is, I believe, to recognize that the community-based agencies are different. There are different services in each community around the state of Florida, and they have to be treated as individual agencies protecting these children. Certainly there has to be a set of outcomes, but they don't all have to get there the same way in the same time frame. And the other thing is, as I mentioned earlier, we have to standardize this from centralization in Tallahassee with people that have not been in the field for years and years, bringing it down to the more local regional levels where people know, the staff know on a day-to-day basis what's really going on and how to turn the knobs to fix the little things to make the big things better.
Jack joining us here on the Florida Roundup from Pompano Beach. Jack knows of which he speaks as the former regional director of the Department of Children and Families in Broward County. And we've got more with our guests on the Florida Roundup, Carol Marvin Miller from the Miami Herald, Mary Ellen Kloss from the Herald, and Greg Allen from National Public Radio. Stick around. Your phone calls, including hearing from some of those who have direct experience with this agency under scrutiny this week here in the state of Florida. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The Florida Department of Children and Families saw more scrutiny this week by judges and the public. 20 kids who had contact with the agency have died since April in Florida, dying from neglect, abuse, drowning, other horrific circumstances the agency is supposed to protect the kids from.
Hi, my name is Ines Morehouse, and I'm actually a family caregiver of a 2.5-year-old child whose parents are both addicted to crack cocaine. And I've been doing extensive research about the topic of how DCF handles cases with children who have parents who are addicted to cocaine. And they're actually very light on these people. They lie, they violate court orders, they get away with a lot, and the urine tests are easily cheated.
Just one of the voices of a Floridian who has some experience with the Department of Children and Families. We're discussing it here on the Florida Roundup. Carol Marvin Miller from the Miami Herald, Mary Ellen Kloss from the Herald, and Greg Allen from National Public Radio. Your phone calls as well at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Follow us on Twitter at WLRN and join the conversation. The live chat underway right now at WLRN.org. Laura joins us on the telephone from Miami. Welcome to the Florida Roundup, Laura. And you have some direct experience with this agency. Tell us about it.
Yes, I do work for the Guardian Ad Litem program, or the Guardian Ad Litem, I should say, and I can say that morale at DCF is definitely low. There's too many cases and just not enough people to cover them. You know, case managers will have cases in Homestead and up by county line, and you want to say, how can DCF improve? Definitely through more community involvement. There are far too many kids, and TDPIs and case managers don't have the time to pay them the attention they deserve. In addition to the interior changes that are needed in DCF, becoming involved in programs such as the Guardian Ad Litem program, where people are volunteers and have the time to care about these kids, will definitely make an impact long term and prevent any more tragedies from occurring.
Laura, we appreciate the ideas here on the Florida Roundup, some ideas being suggested by Laura with direct experience, Carol, with the agency involved here. We've also got a phone call from Ann, who's joining us from Fort Lauderdale. And Ann, I take it that you've also had some experience with this agency.
Yes, I had my grandchildren, actually, whose mother absconded with them to another state. And the other state released the children to me and my husband, and we were asked to follow up with DCF right after we returned to Florida. And after multiple calls to DCF, we never got a response back. They didn't know what to do with our case because it was never a reportable case through DCF from Florida. And so our children actually just fell through the cracks. It was never a follow-up after I called DCF myself more than a half a dozen times.
And I'm so sorry to hear about that and your grandchildren. But, Carol, we're hearing these stories, obviously, of lots of cracks in the system, not only within Florida but between states in these child welfare systems. And the common one of the common voices you're hearing is the number of cases, the geographic location of those cases really stretches the limited resources that this agency has.
Well, and that's a common denominator in social services in Florida across the board. And I'm going to be blunt about this. Florida rations social services. Florida sets finite budgets with dollars that are clearly inadequate to the task. And then Florida will essentially tweak the spigot and turn down the spigot to control the amount of cases coming into the pipeline.
But is that any different than any other social service in any other state?
Yes. The difference between Florida and some other states is that Florida's budget is heavily, heavily weighted toward federal dollars, such as Medicaid and Title IV-E. The states that tend to do child welfare better, such as Illinois, have a much, much more robust general revenue budget and depend far less on Medicaid and Title IV-E. And the reason that that's important is that the federal dollars, generally speaking, are tied to specific services. Florida has what's called a Title IV-E waiver that allows it to spend some of those dollars on prevention and early intervention, but it's still not anywhere near enough. And we have been cutting and cutting and cutting all the subsidiary budgets that go into making these families safer. If a family comes to DCF's attention because one or both of the parents have a drug problem, they're going to need drug treatment. If one or both of the parents are mentally ill, they're going to need mental health care. If one or both parent is abusive, they're going to need batterer's intervention, anger management, etc. We have been cutting those programs to the bone for years. And so you're not helping a child by leaving him in place with parents who can't access the resources that are designed to make them better parents.
Carol Marvin Miller with the Miami Herald here as we're talking about the Department of Children and Families. Greg Allen from National Public Radio also along with us. And Greg, among the real tragic broader stories here as we concentrate on the 20 children in Florida that have died since April with involvement with this agency, there's a long history of kids that have been under the care of the state of Florida that have found significant harm for many, many years.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about there, Tom, is the Dozier School, which has been in the news in the last year or so as the, some of the former residents there, guys who were now in their 60s and 70s, who were kids there, what was basically a reform school, have come forward and talked about the beatings they received and the fact that there are at least 90 bodies, probably many more than that, at the school that were in graves that were never marked. In fact, calling them graves is probably even going too far. Mm-hmm. And this is work that Carol did work on several years ago. One of the first stories that I think that was ran about the telling the stories of some of these kids from Dozier School. Now it looks like we have universities in the University of South Florida who are going up there to look at these, to do some exhumations up there and maybe begin identifying these kids who died there and find out maybe what the circumstances were in which they died.
Yeah, and hopefully write the final chapter for that school and be able to give some sense of peace for those families that have been involved. Talking about the child welfare system here in the state of Florida, Jason calling us on the Florida Roundup from Deerfield Beach. Jason, welcome to WLRN.
How you doing? I just happened to catch you on the radio here, and I'd like to speak about how the judges are making irrational decisions on innocent parents. My girlfriend and I are going through an issue right now with the Miami-Dade court system where her child got injured at daycare, and we filed a police report as soon as our knowledge of it became available, and her ex-husband used it, falsified these restraining order documents, and took us to court. And Judge Maria Espinoza Dennis threw us under the bus, put a permanent restraining order against myself, and a one-year restraining order against my girlfriend without being able to see her son. Miami-Dade DCF is now trying to take her son from her permanently. They have no evidence that the child got hurt in our home. Neither one of us have a criminal record. I'm a combat veteran, and she works for a local municipal police department. I mean, this is, it's just outrageous how, you know, they did no proper investigation, and they're stripping law-abiding citizens of their rights when we did what we were supposed to do.
Jason,
we tried to protect a child from harm.
Jason from Deerfield Beach there, Carol, really kind of giving us yet another side of this problem with child welfare. Difficult, obviously, can't comment on the specifics of that case, but if for those of us looking at the system, you covering the system here, you have the judicial branch in one hand, you have the agency on the other hand, you have biological parents that may be involved, may have some substance abuse issues or other issues, but then you also have obviously parents that may be involved here, rightfully so, that are looking for their day in court to try to explain themselves. I mean, you know, talk to us a little bit about kind of how all these stakeholders have to come together and the difficulty that is that we saw on display, for instance, this week with the judge panel.
I'm not entirely sure I favor all the stakeholders coming together, and here's why. I think that when you have the different branches of government exercising their authority, it's a good thing. And I think part of what has gone wrong over the last several years is that some of the players have acted as virtual rubber stamps for the policies of other players. I think one of the most interesting speakers of the night on Tuesday was Dr. Walter Lambert, who heads the child protection team in Miami-Dade, which is a group of doctors, nurses, social workers who evaluate children for signs of abuse or neglect. And what Dr. Lambert said was, looking straight at the lawmakers, 16 or 17 of them on the dais, you have a role to play here, and you cannot sit up there in judgment of DCF when year after year you have inadequately funded these efforts. I'm less interested in some of what others wanted to see happen at that hearing, which was everyone hold hands and sing Kumbaya. That is not going to fix what's broken. What's going to fix what's broken is to have the discrete entities do their job better and exercise their authority to oversee what some of the other branches are doing.
Well, we saw some of that pressure build in 2002. We saw it build in 2011, and we're seeing it build again here in the late summer of 2013. Carol Marvin-Miller with the Miami Herald along with us here on the Florida Roundup. Still to come, plenty more news happening in the Sunshine State this week, including the second effort to purge voter rolls in Florida. And we'll talk about the coming Obamacare and privacy concerns that the governor has. Welcome back. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Well, for the second time in 2 years, Florida is moving forward with the effort to purge state voter rolls to remove non-citizens. Governor Scott restarted the effort earlier this month after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the portion of the Voting Rights Act requiring states to get the okay from the federal government before changing election rules.
Look, I think it's very important that all of our elections be, you know, honest, ethical, fair, all those things. I want to make sure there's no racial discrimination in any of our elections. But anytime that we have the opportunity to make our own decisions, I think that's great for our state. I want to make sure that every election we have, that the people have a right to vote in our state, you know, go out and vote. But if you don't have a right to vote in our state, you don't go out and vote. So that's why I fought to make sure we had access to the SAVE database that Homeland Security had, so we know whether you have a right to vote in our state. And if there's anybody that we think is not voting, I think we need to look at that's not voting properly. From the standpoint they didn't have a right to vote, I think we need to be doing an investigation.
Governor Scott there on restarting another voter purge effort here in the Sunshine State. Greg Allen from National Public Radio along with us. Mary Ellen Kloss from the Miami Herald and Gina Jordan joining us as well from Tallahassee. Mary Ellen, first of all, what's the focus of this second effort?
Well, it looks as though it's very similar to the first effort. The only difference is that there won't be able to be a lawsuit pegged on the Voting Rights Act because the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in June eliminated that prospect.
So in other words, those who don't want to do the voting purge have lost part of the leverage that they would try to file suit against it.
That's right, right. And that was a pending lawsuit that has now been dismissed because of the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling. So the focus now is that the Secretary of State, Ken Detzner, is going to create a list of suspected non-citizens, and then he's going to cross-check the voter data that is already in the system and cross that with the federal database managed by the Department of Homeland Security and see if they can come up with a list of people that should not be on the voter rolls. The last time they tried this, you know, we all recall they had 182,000 people mm-hmm. they identified as non-citizens, and in the end, only a handful of people were legitimately tossed off.
Yeah, and not only that, Gina Jordan from Tallahassee, it started off at almost 200,000 names on the list. By the time it went on down, it was under 200, and I believe only one person was actually prosecuted for voting when they shouldn't have. So what's the process of the purge? What do we know about that, Gina?
Well, the process has been that they compared information from the driver's license database with voter registration rolls. And they quickly figured out that that was not a very accurate way to look at it. And so the state had tried for months to get access to this SAVE database that stands for the Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlements database. And finally, they got access to that information, which will hopefully make the process a lot more, fewer people will get those letters in the future. Clearly, the driver's license database is out of date, and there wasn't a really good way of checking that compared to the voter rolls to see who was illegally voting.
Now, I've got to ask a real simple question here. Why would somebody be purged?
Well, you know, Tom, if I can jump in, I don't think that if this goes forward, it might be as damaging as last time or potentially damaging. Because if they're going to use the SAVE database, not just use the motor vehicle rolls, theoretically, they're actually going to identify people who are at some question of whether they're citizens or not. And I'm thinking that as you go down the road on this, the numbers will be much smaller. I mean, certainly you're not going to see 180,000 people identified. That's mm-hmm. what was so damaging. Mm-hmm. If they were talking about sending letters to 200,000 voters, most, you know, in Florida, that would be very damaging to the process. If you're talking about dozens, how many people can we be talking about? You
right.
know, and if those letters go out, I don't think anybody will object to that. The question is, this is not, though, and in fact, the question will be whether it is actually cost effective for the state to do this. You know, I mean, the governor says it's all about justice and protecting the
right to
you know,
vote. Sure.
Many of us believe that that's really not really what it's about. It's about influencing the electorate and trying and keeping people home at election time.
Well, we'll talk about that, Mary Ellen, because, you know, presumably if you are a verified voter for the state of Florida, you're not going to show up in this voter purge list, regardless of your political persuasion. You're going to vote, you know, on the issues or on the candidate as opposed to this particular voter purge effort. I got to imagine that most voters would only want the votes that are counted to be from verified voters.
And I have to say that because they're doing this in a year, that's a year away from a general election, they're giving themselves the time to air, you know, to flesh out any errors in the process. So there have been members like Rene Garcia, the senator from Miami, who has indicated that he is confident that if they move slowly with this, that this will not be a bad setup. And it's possible that because they are starting so far ahead, that things may happen in a more routine way. And
I mean, compared to what's going on in other states around the country right now, Florida is actually in the back seat of what's right. happening about these voting rights issues, partly because we've gone down the road before many other states did.
Talk more about that, Greg Allen from National Public Radio, about Florida is not certainly alone in looking at its voter rolls and trying to purge names that are on those voter rolls that should not be allowed to vote.
Right. This is going forward in different ways, shapes, and forms in many other states. As I say, the dirty little secret here, and I don't think it's a secret to anyone who follows politics, is that the rules of who's allowed to go and vote and how you register to vote can really influence the electorate. And that's a very important issue here. And that's at least one of the underlying issues here that does not actually come out in sound bites often from the people who are playing this. And that's what's happening now.
It is the Florida Roundup. That is Greg Allen from NPR, Mary Ellen Kloss from the Miami Herald, and Gina Jordan, also from the Herald, joining us from Tallahassee. You can join in as well online at WLRN.org, on Twitter at WLRN, or give us a holler at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Philip is joining the conversation here on the Florida Roundup from Fort Lauderdale. Philip, go ahead.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon, and great show, as always. And the question in search for a comment, intelligent comment, is, how come the right to vote is such a precious, wonderful thing that extraordinary measures have to be taken, like what we're doing in Florida? And on the other hand, about gun control, which is in the Constitution too, and it's part of a big part of American culture, that one is untouchable. For one, there is empirical knowledge that voters' fraud is not a regular thing. It's very rare. On the other hand, fatal accidents, crime, et cetera, is empirically proven. On the other hand, why isn't that question being asked?
Well, Philip from Fort Lauderdale, interesting question here. I'm not sure that we have any specific answers, but an interesting thought experiment, really balancing the constitutional right to vote if you meet certain criteria versus the constitutional right to own a firearm.
Do you remember, Mary Ellen, at the debate, was it 2 years ago, who was the elected official who said that in Africa some people have to walk 100 miles to vote? We shouldn't make it easy for people to vote. This was the position laid out on the floor of I forget if it was the House or the Senate.
It was Senator Bennett in the Senate.
Yeah, it's one of the classic Florida quotes where he said, well, we don't really need to make it easy for people to vote in Florida. In Africa, people walk 100 miles, which, of course, was ludicrous, as we found out later, of course.
Yeah.
Maybe it was knew that at the time.
I want to pose the question, though, again, Gina, I mean, why would a name be purged from a voter roll? In other words, how would a name show up on a voter roll or somebody show up on a voter roll who shouldn't be there?
One way that state leaders say this has been happening is that someone will try to get a driver's license. They will get a driver's license even though they're not a citizen, and they can do that legally. And then at the same time, perhaps they will go ahead and register to vote even though they're not allowed to do that. And so that's one way that the state says people are getting away with voting illegally. What they found, though, is that the information with the motor vehicles is outdated. So you might have someone who would get a driver's license, and a few months later, they would become a citizen. But that information wasn't updated. Mm-hmm. So the state, at first anyway, state leaders thought perhaps that was happening. But again, they quickly found out that there were not even 200 legitimately questionable cases that they were able to find.
Mary Ellen, is voter purging from rolls something that traditionally has not been done on a regular basis, or has it become a political issue, to Greg's point, partly because of really the politics and the timing that we saw and the Voting Rights Act decision by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, no, it actually is something that the Department of State has done routinely every election year. And they've gotten into trouble in the past when they've changed the way they did it. And they relied on a software company, and the database was wrong. And that put Catherine Harris in trouble mm-hmm. several years ago. This is a responsibility of the supervisors of elections. They need to make sure their voter database is reliable and accurate. And they want people who can vote, only the people that are allowed to vote.
And, you know, that's an interesting, you know, checks and balances, if there is such a thing, is that those are elected officials. The, you know, the Secretary of State, of course, is an appointed official who works for the governor. And you could say that could be a political position then, right? He's part of the administration.
You wouldn't be alone in saying that.
Right. And the supervisor of elections actually answer to the voters. And many of these people, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, take their jobs very seriously. And I think a lot of them had questions about the purge last time. And that's why I don't think we'll have a problem with the purge this time if it goes forward the way it's starting to proceed.
I think the central question here then to Gina and to Mary Ellen and to Greg, are non-citizens voting in the state of Florida? And what do we know about that? How many? How often? And how long?
Well, the interesting thing to me is that this is a policy that obviously is geared and has the greatest potential to affect people of, you know, minority origin. So when you are somebody who, you know, states with Hispanics, for example, are the ones that have had the biggest people who've been identified as, you know, on these voter purge lists.
Right.
And that is a problem because there is an assumption built into that. And somehow I think that until they get their query and their database fixed, they're going to continue to run into that. And that's where the political pushback is.
If a Hispanic Democratic governor was doing this, would we hear so much about it?
Well, As I say, I'm not sure how cost effective it would be. And we'll see how much it costs. And this was a big issue the last purge is how much, you know, why can't we do it and how much is going to cost? And if it's going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to run a purge or a queries that will turn up a dozen people,
right.
I think even someone who looks at costs so closely as Governor Scott might question whether that makes sense. And so that, let's see if it even goes forward is what I'm wondering.
And there is the other issue, and that is that there's sort of a control factor right now. We've got the Secretary of State, which is the one that is putting the list together. Supervisors of elections have asked, we want access to your list and your database so that we can check this because we're on the ground. You know, we'll get this before it goes into the system, and they're not allowing that. So, you know, it's a little tug and pull. It is not always a partisan battle. It's bipartisan in many ways. But I think there is a potential that they've got more kinks to work out.
The politics and the policy of voter purging underway or soon to be underway in the state of Florida. Gina Jordan from Tallahassee joining us. Mary Ellen Kloss from the Miami Herald here in studio with Greg Allen from National Public Radio. It is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Just 2 months now and Floridians are supposed to be able to shop for health insurance as part of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. Now, if you've gone out there to shop for health coverage, you know how tough it is to navigate between all the policies, premiums, coverage, deductibles, you name it. So the government is setting up helpers to reach out to those without health insurance. Now, in Miami for his monthly cabinet meeting this week, Governor Scott and the state attorney general, Pam Bondi, complained there's not enough privacy protections for Floridians.
It is unclear how the federal government will protect personal information from being stolen or otherwise misused.
And our citizens need to know that information that they're giving up could compromise their safety and security.
Greg Allen from NPR was at that cabinet meeting. How are these navigators supposed to work? What's the information that's part of the complaint?
Well, the idea here is, Thomas, someone has to go and reach out, do outreach and education to the people who can go and shop now at these health exchanges. Now, as you know, Florida is not setting up its own health exchange. The governor and legislature decided not to do that. The federal government is going to set one up. And someone has to do the outreach to let the people know there's millions of uninsured people in Florida, and many of those people now will be able to go and shop for health insurance with subsidies. So the navigators are people who will be hired by social service agencies, nonprofits, I think, totally in Florida, and they'll be working with people to educate them about the Affordable Care Act, and they'll be doing town halls, they'll be going to shopping centers, they'll be going door-to-door, and they'll be reaching out and telling people about what their options are if they qualify for subsidies and then how they go about shopping for health insurance. And, of course, we do have a mandate, so many of these people will have to have self-insurance under the law by January 1st.
Of course, Florida was one of those states that led the effort to try to stop the ACA from becoming enforced. But here we are now. We're 2 months away from these health exchanges beginning. Governor Scott mentioning privacy concerns. How validated are these concerns?
Well, there is, let's always say, a certain amount of politics, at least in my view, in this. I mean, everyone is concerned about privacy. The Kathleen Sebelius and others at the federal government say, we've done this very same thing with Medicaid recipients and Medicare recipients. We take take their Social Security numbers. We help them apply. We help them find coverage. We will use the same safeguards. Now, the governor and Attorney General Bondi think they don't have enough assurances on that. If they're right, then I'll, you know, we'll stand. We'll find out. But I think there's a certain amount of political pushback there. They still want to show that they don't really support this act, and there's a strong groundswell among Tea Party people and other conservatives that still don't like the Affordable Care Act, even though it's the law and it's going into effect.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's the effort, the continuous effort to some degree on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. to try to defund or underfund, of course, all these efforts, Mary Ellen. But as Greg points out, October 1st is going to come. That's going to become open enrollment. January 1st is going to come, and that's when the ACA really begins to come into full force. Talk to us about a little bit of the politics behind this. Is Governor Scott and the AG Bondi really just, again, trying to stir up the pot of their hardcore supporters looking to the next election cycle?
Well, I think there is a great deal of that. I mean, if you look at where things are at Capitol Hill, you look at Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who is basically traveling the country, and everywhere he goes, he is talking about the need to repeal Obamacare. This is an agenda that they want to keep the momentum going on. I think they see that the clock is ticking a little bit, because once the program gets into place and if people become satisfied with it, then it's a little bit harder to repeal or make that argument. However, there are a lot of unanswered questions, sure, as we've already known, with the employer mandate being delayed a year. The federal government has a lot of issues that it's got to work out. So there's a lot of fodder here for political exploitation, and that's what this is. And they're just keeping the momentum.
You know, and it's going to look a little bit like a political campaign here over the next several months, because you've got, I guess, former Senator DeMint, who's with Heritage Foundation, who was here in Tampa, I think, just this week.
Former Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina.
And big town meeting, and this is all about, you know, let's defund Obamacare, let's get a government shutdown if necessary. At the same time, you have, of course, the Navigators, which is a government-funded group, but you've got a lot of an offshoot of President Obama's campaign organization that is turned into a group that's working to sell the health care, Affordable Care Act to Floridians and let them know their options. You've got them working, you've got others going door-to-door. So you'll see actually canvassing, and you'll see people at shopping centers, I think, on both sides of this issue as we go forward the next few months.
Just when you thought you'd be able to get through a fall without a political campaign, here we go in the fall of 2013, the politics of the Affordable Care Act coming to bear in the state of Florida. Gina Jordan joining us from Tallahassee with the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen Kloss from the Miami Herald joining us here in studio at WLRN, and Greg Allen from National Public Radio as well. Now online at WLRN.org, we do have a consumer guide to Obamacare, so be sure to check that out. Finally, 40 years in the making this week, the 1972 perfect season, Miami Dolphins got the White House treatment.
I did have to explain to my staff, who mostly are in their early 30s, what an incredible impact these guys had, including on me, when they were playing. You know, these Dolphins made history back before Super Bowl champs started visiting the White House. The first teams didn't start coming until after 1980. And let's face it, this is also just a fun thing to do. I like doing it as president.
So 40 years in the making, almost the entire team and coaches who are still with us joining the president there in the White House this week to celebrate that 1972-1973 17-0 season with the Miami Dolphins. That is the Florida Roundup this week here in late August. Thank you for joining us. If you missed any of the program and you'd like to hear it again, it will be on the air 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. And, of course, the entire program on demand at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our executive producer here at WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor, Paul Leary, once again doing a marvelous job. Thank you, sir. South Florida Arts Beat is next right here on WLRN. Be sure to stay tuned. And don't forget the Sunshine Economy Monday at 9 a.m. We're talking retail in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.